This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Yesterday, Tony Harp won the New Haven Democratic primary for mayor in a landslide. Bill de Blasio may have avoided a runoff with a decisive victory in the New York City mayoral primary. West Springfield voters shot down a bid by Hard Rock to build a casino there, and Tom Foley got a little closer to a run for governor with an announcement and some allegations against Governor Malloy. These are all things you'd probably hear on a regular Wednesday edition of our news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. But like much of the rest of the country and the world, we've been fixated by the on-again, off-again drama surrounding Syria. In just the last few days, we've gone from the Obama administration pushing Congress hard for authorization of a military strike against the regime of Bashar al-Assad. The administration's message about why such an attack is necessary was confusing at best, ranging from a need to punish Assad for using chemical weapons against his own people, a need to influence the uprising against Assad by rebels, and a need to send a message about American might to the Middle East. Not surprisingly, lawmakers of both parties and Americans of all types expressed their skepticism. Here's Senator Chris Murphy speaking on a conference call last night following President Obama's speech.
I've never seen people in Connecticut as plugged into an issue as they have been over Syria. And overwhelmingly, people do not want the United States to commit military resources to Syria. And that concern comes from both the left and the right.
A lot of that skepticism can be traced back to a kind of deja vu. I mean, didn't we just get out of a war in Iraq that was prompted by threats of weapons of mass destruction, weapons that never materialized? That's not lost on New Mexico Senator Tom Udall, a Democrat, heard here on the podcast Decode DC.
I see this potential bombing campaign as a potential next step towards full-fledged war. We've been here before. Americans are understandably weary. After the fiasco of Iraq and over a decade of war, how can this administration make a guarantee that our military actions will be limited? How can we guarantee that one surgical strike will have any impact other than to tighten the vice grip Assad has on his power, or allow rebels allied with al-Qaeda to gain a stronger foothold in Syria?
But within the last few days, a new twist, Russia seizes on an offhand remark by Secretary of State John Kerry to propose that with Russian help, the Syrians would turn over the chemical weapons stash. It allowed the president, who had been politically hemmed in by his own pronouncements, to present a very different message in his speech last night.
I have therefore asked the leaders of Congress to postpone a vote to authorize the use of force while we pursue this diplomatic path. I'm sending Secretary of State John Kerry to meet his Russian counterpart on Thursday. And I will continue my own discussions with President Putin. I've spoken to the leaders of two of our closest allies, France and the United Kingdom, and we will work together in consultation with Russia and China to put forward a resolution at the UN Security Council requiring Assad to give up his chemical weapons and to ultimately destroy them under international control.
Today, where we live on this September 11th, we want to hear from you about the possibility of U.S. military intervention in Syria. What are the global threats that you think prompt military action? Are you convinced by the evidence presented by the government? Are you convinced that Russia can be counted on to broker a deal with Syria? We do want to hear from you. We haven't had a chance to have a long-form conversation about Syria on the show, and I know a lot of you want to get involved in the conversation, so call us at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at Where We Live. As always on Wednesdays for The Wheelhouse, Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show, is here with me. Good morning, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Before we get to some analysis of what the president said last night and where we are in this crisis, I'd like to get your reaction to something that we heard from Senator Chris Murphy, that he is going around the state and hearing that people are more plugged into the Syrian crisis than ever before. People are really paying attention. Is that what you feel here in Connecticut today?
I know I underlined that actually when you played that quote. I think he has a very short memory. No, I mean, you could name 10 other things within the last 10 years that people in Connecticut have been more plugged into in terms of national issues. And certainly, I mean, the debate over our entry into Iraq was far more feverish, far more detailed than this. Now, this is... It almost sort of fits with President Obama's speech last night, which I sort of thought was Churchill for Generation X. You know, it was kind of, you know, we shall fight them with modest effort and risk. And if it becomes unpleasant, we shall stop. You know, I don't think that anybody is really fully engaged with this, or I think very, very few people are fully engaged with this issue. People basically are reacting to this issue in just the way that President Obama suggested last night, they don't really want it to mess up their lives, which is really different from being plugged in.
Well, and I think, you know, I wanted to underscore the fact that indeed this is September 11th. It's a time in which we do think about how the United States has been involved in global politics in a different way over the course of the last decade plus. As you look back on this day, does that have anything to do with it? I mean, Americans in some ways have long memories, in other ways have very, very short memories. We're looking back at this terrorist act that affected us so, and maybe we're not learning some of the same lessons. Maybe we're just worried about getting back to our day-to-day lives.
Americans have incredibly short memories, and actually I don't think that their memories on this kind of issue reach all the way back to September 11th. I think their memories reach back to the involvement in Iraq that followed September 11th, that was argued for partly on the basis of September 11th. I mean, fallaciously argued for on the basis of September 11th. I think that's how far back their memories. I mean, post September 11th, it was pretty easy to motivate the American public to do something. People wanted to do something. They wanted to perceive that they had enemies. They wanted to perceive that there were threats to American safety and stability, and that most of those threats emanated from the Middle East. So it was pretty easy to motivate people. Well, look today. I mean, President Obama really can muster at best the tiniest flicker of enthusiasm for that kind of thing, which I think tells you how long it is, at least in American memory, from September 11th.
We'll get to some of your phone calls at 860-275-7266 in just a moment, but we want to bring in Scott Bates, president of the Center for National Policy. He lives in Stonington and is a regular contributor to WNPR, but joins us by phone today from Washington, D.C., where he's doing work on this very issue. Scott, welcome back to the show.
Well, it's good to be with you, and thanks for mentioning September 11th, and I know a lot of the families listen to your show, so our thoughts are with them today.
I'm wondering if you can, perhaps before you give us your take on what President Obama had to say last night, maybe talk about your feelings on what Colin and I have just been discussing, about whether or not America is ready to have a conversation about this, whether or not Americans are really plugged into this issue the way that the Obama administration or perhaps Chris Murphy says they are.
I saw a statistic, it might be wrong, so take it with a grain of salt, but that the web traffic for America's Got Talent was getting 12 times more hits than queries about the Syria situation. So I'm not gonna say that's I don't know if Syria is at the top of the mind of everyone, you know, out there. But if you're talking about military families, if you're talking about those that are going to be directly impacted, I think it's a topic of conversation, but it's very confused because the administration itself has had very confusing messages. And I think to go back to your September 11th reference, it's important because I think what we learned is that the world is a very complex place, that our reactions as a country matter, that the law of unintended consequences prevails, and that the world is small. There's no escaping instability in any part of the world. So, by the way, the prescriptions on how to handle that kind of world are contradictory. I've been contending that we actually need more and broader engagement in the Middle East, but not of a military nature, if that makes sense. We can't go back to a world in which we are insulated and isolated from what's happening in the Middle East. The world's way too small for that now. On the other hand, if we react in an emotional way to situations, if we react without alliances and without credibility, then it comes at the cost of our leadership at a minimum and at a maximum in real life and treasure. And that's really the legacy of the last 12 years, I think, that we've seen.
Well, as I ask you to analyze what you heard from the president last night, maybe you can talk about that broader attempt at what we'll call diplomacy in the Middle East. What you're calling for, Scott Bates, and what a lot of people who do the work you do, watching this all the time, say is we need to be more engaged in events there, not just when there is a crisis. When President Obama says we're going to hold off on a vote on military action in order to approach this one diplomatic effort, it's essentially a diplomatic effort to try to solve this one problem in this one way. It's not the broader diplomacy that I think you're calling for. So with that background, what did you think of what the president said last night?
Well, you know, his argument has a strong moral force. The real question that we have to get to, and I think the way the president needed to frame this from the beginning, is not necessarily global America as global cop or America as enforcer of international norms. If he goes for that, You know, I'll agree with that. Maybe some people will. But the American people as a whole have a real problem with that at this point. They're going to say, why do we have to always be the ones? And the sad fact is because we're the ones with the capability and the will, and the will is now questionable. Is the world safer if we have these norms and such? I think absolutely. But here's the thing. The president needs to look at this through an American national security lens. And I would say, number one, what we have in Syria is two acknowledged terrorist networks on an unstable battlefield with weapons of mass destruction rolling around that battlefield. So, you know, where we are now is not necessarily a bad place. Where we got, how we got here in, over the last 2 weeks has been an absolute hash. But right now is the approach, which is working with the international community to get those chemical weapons off the battlefield that would prevent their future use. Would a military strike prevent their future use? Perhaps not. And so this approach now, I think, has a decent chance of success and makes a lot of sense. And if you're going to resort to force, this approach has to be tried, but it wasn't beforehand, and that, I think, was a tactical mistake. And the other is, I call it catastrophic success. What happens if we actually push the house of cards too hard and Assad falls? And then you're talking about a massive international stabilization effort, which no one is prepared for. So I think the president last night, he probably, I don't know if he should have made the speech, to be honest with you. Diplomatic events are moving quickly. I think he was trying to strengthen his hand, but for something that isn't happening yet, he had to pull that vote from Congress. And at the end of the day, it was not looking good in the Congress, I think, because of the reaction of the American people.
You know, Scott, I think a lot of people are curious as to why Putin, why Russia would step forward, why, for that matter, Syria would step forward and offer President Obama, who was floundering, a stick to pull him out of the water this way. And one question that I had for you is, I guess I was trying to look at this through Putin's eyes, through Assad's eyes. You know, Assad really wants to go on, basically, I assume, fighting the war the way that he's been fighting it. Putin wants to go on being Putin. And I wonder to what degree they look at all this and think, well, if the U.S. wants to fetishize the chemical weapons issue, I mean, really, Assad is not fighting this war with chemical weapons. He's fighting it with a vast array of different military options. If the U.S. wants to obsess about chemical weapons while I, Assad, continue to do what I've always been doing, fine, you know, let them obsess about this. And I don't mean to suggest the chemical weapons aren't a serious issue. Obviously, they are. But I don't see how this really slows Assad down all that much.
Well, I think you're right about that. And at the end of the day, Syria matters to Russia only within the context, getting to what Putin wants. Putin wants to be taken seriously, to be seen to his domestic public as a world player and have leverage in different spots around the world, to be kind of sidelined, like in Libya. Is a humiliation to Russian pride. And so he wasn't going to let that happen again. So for him, doing this kind of deal with Assad shows that he's got real juice in the Middle East. He is more clever than the President of the United States from his perspective and is bailing out the United States. So that's a pretty good place for him to be in. And that's why I say, you know, this is a smart move on his part. And as you said, for Assad, losing that chemical capability, it will cost him with some of his commanders. That will be a hard discussion. They like that security blanket. But you're right. Tactically, he was winning the war. So it is stunning that they were used. I think this does show the instability of the situation, though. Regional commanders have been given the authority to use these weapons based on intelligence reports. It makes it very unstable. So from his perspective, it might be good to get them out because he's not really in control of those weapons right now.
Get them out of the hands of his own military before they do something like this that puts him in trouble again. I want to bring into the conversation Akshan Bayolgun, who is an associate professor in UConn's Department of Political Science and who's an expert on Russia and in other things in this region. Akshan, I welcome you to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I'm wondering if you can jump in on what Colin had asked Scott about why you believe Russia has decided to get involved in this way. And secondary to that, do you think that the United States can trust Russian involvement right now?
Well, I mean, the recent events in the past week and couple of days have really given Putin a chance, an opportunity to step in and play a strategic and central role in this conflict. The first, the British parliamentary vote against intervention, and Obama's decision to seek congressional approval, and then the waning public support here in the United States for an intervention, really has provided an opening for Putin. And He would like to maintain control of the Syrian conflict to avoid a situation similar to Libya. The Libya experience really weighs heavily in Russia's decisions, and they don't want to be dismissed. They don't want to be sidelined as a spoiler on the international stage. They want a new world order, and they want to be in the driver's seat. So I think this is a great opportunity for Putin to sort of intervene in this conflict. Whether or not U.S. can trust Russia, that's a big debate, right? I mean, this is something a lot of people are really concerned about. But I think Russia has a genuine interest in preventing a military intervention in Syria. Russia has long and old ties with Syria. Syria is Russia's closest and possibly only ally in the Middle East today. Russia has strategic interests from the naval base on the Mediterranean to commercial interests, the arms sale and a lot of investments of Russian firms in Syria's infrastructure, energy, tourism industries. There are several thousand Russian citizens who live in Russia. Russia has humanitarian concerns for them. And most importantly, perhaps, Russia does not want Syria, a state collapse in Syria. And in that sense, I think Russia and U.S. have similar goals. They do not want instability in Syria. Kremlin fears that the instability in Syria may spill over to its own territory. They think that the radicals and extremists can turn Syria into a safe haven for al-Qaeda-style terrorists, and they're really worried about this northward spread of Islamic militancy. So they have a stake in this, and perhaps we should be trusting them.
We're going to talk more about the Russian stake in all of this and also more about chemical weapons as we continue our conversation about Syria in the Wheelhouse today. When we come back, though, Andrea Seabrook from Decode DC, who covers the domestic political structure around all this, she'll be joining us from Baltimore, and we'll also continue our conversation with our other guests. We want to hear from you, 860-275-7266. You can also email wherewelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at wherewelive. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today it's our Wednesday News Roundtable, The Wheelhouse, and we're focusing on Syria today. We're talking about Syria with you at 860-275-7266 and guests in studio and around the country. We want to bring in Andrea Seabrook, who's host of the podcast Decode DC. She joins us from the studios of WYPR in Baltimore, Maryland. She's been taking a look at some of the domestic political ideas, question marks around Syria. And Andrea, welcome back to our show.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks.
So in your most recent podcast, you took a look at this. And maybe you can give me your outline on how this debate has been playing out in Syria. Scott Bates, who we've been talking to, is in Washington right now, talking with people all across Washington. And there's a lot of question marks. What are you hearing right now on Capitol Hill?
Well, I think someone said earlier that the president has been foundering in this debate. And I think, actually, when you see the Congress, just hear any member of Congress take something seriously, talk across party lines, join forces with other ones, talk about the gravity of the situation. I mean, what I see is a liberal democracy taking on an incredibly serious issue with great seriousness. I think we spend a lot of time wanting things to be swift and decisive, but in fact, in a robust democratic society, things are messy. And I think actually the Congress has handled this pretty well so far. I think you kind of have to take the president's point as well, at least as a possibility, that Putin and Syria wouldn't have come to this point if they hadn't seen that that the United States would eventually become joined in some way, would eventually come to some point. And in a way, only Putin could fit this diplomatic slot. It's like, there's a lot of politics in here. And so what we see in Washington is an ever-changing situation where people, just hours ago, seemingly, you know, there was a vote and a debate planned in on the U.S. Senate floor, and everyone was sort of thinking, okay, in the House will follow, and how will it work, and what will happen? And now I think there's a lot of relief that at least the president is showing he's willing to follow the possibilities of diplomatic solution. And I think this also, by the way, strengthens the hand of Obama and those who would like to act militarily when or if it doesn't pan out.
Well, let's hear from Jim Himes, the congressman from Fairfield County. He was just speaking to our morning edition this morning about this very issue.
Interestingly, you know, you ask how people feel about a military attack. If you think about the nature of this chess game, the probability of success, that is, the Russians and the Syrians really doing what they say they're going to do, increases the more they believe that the president is likely to revert to a military strike if the deal fails. So, you know, I think the president did a pretty good job of saying, I'm dead serious about this, open to a diplomatic solution, but if that doesn't work, we're back to where we were.
And what we're hearing from Jim Himes there, Andrew Seabrook, sounds to me like some Democrats who've been very skeptical, at least coming around to this idea that now the administration, with this Russia deal perhaps in place, has gotten things back on the rails, that maybe we're heading toward a solution that makes a little bit more sense.
Yeah, and if we aren't heading, if it doesn't make sense, if we get you know, hoodwinked or messed about, as we seem to often be when it comes to these kinds of diplomatic attempts to secure weapons of mass destruction, I think the president has a much stronger case and has built that case already for doing something, for putting real might behind the threats and really not threats, but calls to uphold an international standard for humanity against these kinds of weapons. It's a very interesting situation as somebody who covers Congress, because it has looked in the eyes of outsiders, I think, very messy. But on the inside, for once, it looks very, very serious and actually rational. It's surprising.
It is surprising. Colin?
I just wondered if we're maybe putting too nice a face on this. I feel as though I've been watching a Pink Panther movie about the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I mean, we have a situation in which they really do seem to have stumbled towards a semi-okay solution, not of their making at all. I mean, if you go back and you look at what John Kerry said initially when he first shoved this idea out on the table, he talked about inspections and monitoring, and then he said, which is never going to happen.
Never
going to
work.
There's no possibility it's going to happen. It's never going to happen. I think we have to take him at his word that that's actually what he believed, and that he and President Obama are as surprised as anybody else to find this on the table. For them to now suggest, well, we got there because of our quote unquote unbelievably small military action that we were threatening. Well, if that's true, it is entirely by accident.
Scott Bates jumping in. Yeah. Scott, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, on Saturday afternoon, I was actually talking about that very option with a person from a rival think tank, and we were both in touch with some congressional staff. So what I'm going to say to you is that John Kerry actually knew about that option ahead of time. And I don't know if the question was planted with a reporter or, but, you know, he had the ability 36 hours before that. This kind of Russian plan was actually being discussed around D.C. And I think Colin's right to a great extent. It's a messy process, but it's working toward potentially good solution. But that was not the first time he had probably heard that idea out there.
So, also, I don't think, to me, it didn't sound like they were saying, oh, look, we orchestrated this diplomatic solution. I think they just said this never would have been offered if we hadn't sat up and said this is unacceptable in the first place.
Right. And so now we are in the position where we have to hope and that's where I would say it's interesting to believe that. Now the argument is much easier for Congress, which is that the president is saying, look, I want to pursue diplomacy first. He hadn't really led with that, and now that's where he's headed. And he's saying, I want to go through a UN process and consultations. but I do need the threat of the use of force. That would have been probably a much easier sell to Congress. Still hard, but better than the way it was initially presented.
We're talking about Syria on the program today, and we're going to get to some of your thoughts now at 860-275-7266. Let's go to John, who's calling from Stanford. Hello, John. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hello, John. Very complicated subject, so I want to bring some light to it here. Sarin gas is actually an acronym for Schrader, Ambrose, Rudiger, and von Lind, who were the five scientists who put it together under the leadership of Mr. Otto Ambrose, the chief poison gas scientist to Hitler. And sarin gas was incorporated in the 3 or 4G gases, which were known as the Gerhard gases after Mr. Schrader, which was a combination of isopropyl alcohol and organophosphate chemistry. They were patented in 1937 and 1938, and along with Tabun and Soman. And these gases were forbidden to be used by Hitler, even though Ambrose approached Hitler with them. They actually began to manufacture munitions with them, but Hitler forbade them on the battlefield. Hitler was also gassed in World War I, and that was one of the reasons he did it. These gases were ubiquitous. The United States engaged in the massive, massive undertaking of creation of sarin, Soman, and Tabun gas. That would have been at the Rocky Mountain Arsenal from, you know, like the late 40s all the way through 1974. Curiously, in 1998 through the year 2000, 10 of the sarin bomblets were found sitting in a bunch of discarded metal on the site, which was open to Boy Scout troops at the time. And embarrassment after embarrassment, they had to erect a $6 million facility to eliminate these M134 bomblets, which were from the Honest John rocket era when we were putting these rockets in the Fulda Gap against Soviet tanks.
Well, John, give me your take very quickly, if you would. Knowing what you know about sarin gas, do you believe that the United States has some sort of moral responsibility to do something about Bashar al-Assad or anybody else in the world having these weapons and using them?
So give me a chance, John.
Go ahead, but do it quickly because I got a lot of people on the phone too. Go ahead, John.
We speak from the empty pulpit of arrogance. The United States conducted Operation 112 SHAD, S-H-A-D, Shipboard Defense, which was conducted from 62 to 74. We sprayed over 5,000 U.S. soldiers with sarin, Soman, Tabun, VX, and many other things. We never told those soldiers that they had been exposed. They were naval personnel, army personnel. It is absolutely hypocritical of us to be pointing the finger at, Saddam Hussein, who used these weapons when we were watching him stockpile them 4 times in 1988 of April. Sarin gas was used on Iranian troops.
Well,
they came across the Al-Saul. So it is absolutely disingenuous. We have to go back to the Al-Shifa plant in 1998.
And John, I'm going to let you go just because I want to get some reaction. And thank you very much for your phone call from some of our panelists, Akshan Bayulgan. Give me a sense. So you hear some of the history here from John, who we know to the show and who has some expertise in these issues. Look, do you think that the United States is, as he says, hypocritical in striking out potentially against the Syrian regime for having the same sorts of chemical weapons that we have long had ourselves and many of our other allies have long had ourselves?
It's not so much what I think, but I think a lot of Russian people think that there is a Western hypocrisy when it comes to interventionism. And this is one of Putin's trademarks, right, that he is very much opposed to the West's propensity for unilateral interventionism and regime change. He sees a pattern in the repeated use of force to overthrow leaders from Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and then diplomatic pressure to dislodge some regimes in Tunisia, Egypt. And so Russia wants to send a message to the West about their distaste for interference in any country's internal affairs. Putin is really committed to maintaining the sovereignty of existing states, especially since most of the regimes that have been overthrown after the Cold War were the regimes that were friendly to Russia. So there is an overwhelming sense in Russia that there is a hypocrisy going on here. And Russia and Putin actually capitalizes on this traditional Russian suspicions of the West. I mean, let's not forget, Kremlin foreign policy is largely addressed to the domestic audience. And so it's not much so much of a struggle for Syria, but a struggle against the West. And this is a winning strategy. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union, many Russian leaders have had a tendency to engage in anti-American rhetoric based on these suspicions of hypocrisy, and the public supports that.
It seems as though, you know, to a lot of us looking at this, though, the overarching problems in Syria are not going to be solved probably between just negotiations between Russia and the United States. This ought to be a UN problem. It ought to be a world problem. What are the chances that Putin lets this really go to the UN? It seems like he doesn't want a UN resolution.
Well, it doesn't. It doesn't. I mean, Putin has said all along that any foreign military intervention must be approved by the UN Security Council, which, of course, includes Russia. UN Security Council is Russia's biggest diplomatic trump. You know, that's where they actually rely on, because then they can have a say in what goes on in the world. And they also oppose any regime change under pressure from outside. So they do want, in some ways, to bring the UN Security Council, but they do not want a use of force in Syria. And so the latest statement by Lavrov wants a Security Council wants a statement by the council's president, who is now, I think, rotating and now has an Austrian Australian as the president. Some statement that would welcome the plan to monitor and ultimately destroy Syria's chemical weapons, but not necessarily a UN resolution, because that UN resolution would bring the threat of use of force, and Putin wants to eliminate that completely.
Scott Bates, I'm wondering if you can just jump in on the possibility of international intervention in this way that our guests are talking about whether or not this is a Russian and American problem, or whether or not that this is a UN problem, and if it's a UN problem, can they truly do anything substantive about it?
Well, if you're talking about just specifically on the chemical weapons, yes, the UN could take real action on that. There are organizations that have experience and capability getting rid of these weapons, but be assured we would need thousands of armed troops in Syria protecting those who are removing those weapons. This is an active war zone, and we would need to be engaged with both sides in an active civil war, ensuring safe transit for weapons of mass destruction and for civilians who are monitoring. So they would be under blue helmets, as they call it. So we would have troops from a lot of different countries providing security, and there would be casualties. I think we have to be real about that. But it's a real option, and it's in Russia's interests, actually, to see that kind of solution. To the wider question Colin was touching on, the Syrian civil war, yes, it should be a concern for the entire region and for the world generally. It has the capability to spin out into a Sunni-Shia bigger contest all the way from Baghdad to Beirut. The borders out there are just basically fiction anyway, and this conflict could spill over everywhere. I think when the president's weighing the use of force in this instance, he has to keep in mind two bigger plays. He may need to go back for a resolution on the use of force in some way and build an international coalition on two other issues. One is Iran, don't forget that, and their pursuit of a nuclear weapon. And the other is if Syria falls to pieces. And for the president to effectively respond to either one of those, he would need an international coalition and a U.S. congressional authorization. So in many ways, how he plays this is going to dictate his ability to take care of those two potential future problems.
We're talking with Scott Bates, who's president of the Center for National Policy. He lives in Stonington, and he regularly contributes to WNPR. He's in Washington by phone right now. Akshan Bayulgan is an associate professor at UConn's Department of Political Science. Colin McEnroe, of course, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, joins us. And when we come back, we'll hear more from Andrea Seabrook. She's host of the podcast Decode DC. She's at WYPR in Baltimore. Her latest podcast takes a look at some of the echoes of Afghanistan and Iraq and how people in Washington are considering these previous wars as we talk about Syria here on the Wheelhouse on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we're sick of hearing about Dave Chappelle's Hartford hating, but the debacle raised a lot of questions about racism in Connecticut. Coming up, we'll talk to a panel about the kind of racism that still exists in Connecticut and across New England. Some say it's everywhere. We just don't talk about it. So tomorrow, we will. You can join the conversation on Where We Live. Hope you can join the conversation with us live tomorrow night. We're at the Vanilla Bean out in Pomfret, Connecticut at 5 p.m. for one of our Small Business After Hours events. We'll be talking about what's driving the economy in the quiet corner. I hope you can join us. If you want to sign up to be there, you can go to our website, WNPR.org. Keyword small biz. Today it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, and we're talking about Syria. I want to bring in Andrea Seabrook, who's the host of the podcast Decode DC. And on your podcast, Andrea, you played some tape from Senator Dick Durbin, who discussed America's other war in Afghanistan, perhaps how that's maybe shaping some thinking in Washington.
I still believe that was the right thing to do. But I didn't know at the time that I voted for that authorization for the use of military force. I was voting for the longest war in the history of the United States and an authority to several presidents to do things that no one ever could have envisioned at that moment in history.
And Andrea, this comes up time and time again in your podcast, this idea that people in Washington are concerned about long-term military engagement in the Middle East again.
Yes, and I think they feel a little bit bitten. Twice bitten, four times shy, I guess, in this case, because they have been asked repeatedly, Congress, by different presidents. I'm not going to lump it all on President Bush either. We can talk about the first Gulf War, too, to support a quick and decisive and clean military action, the kind of easy, sort of cruelty-free military action that is a fiction. They've been asked to do that for the last couple of decades in the Middle East, and almost every single time it has either not achieved its goals or it has drawn the United States into a larger and longer war than we ever envisioned, including the top brass and the smartest minds in the military, our best advisors. So there is a kind of, excuse the pun, but gun-shy attitude in the Congress, which I think, interestingly, parallels that of the Western democracies that we're trying to get to support us, but for a very different reason. One other thing I bring up in my podcast is the fact that we still have an all-volunteer force, and that in many respects, it's easy, or at least easier than it used to be, for military heads, for brass, to say, yes, let's go, because they don't have to consider the implications of having, you know, a child from every neighborhood in the country in that force.
Yeah.
And so, in fact, there's not a lot of American skin in the game when it comes to that.
In your podcast, you talk with Andrew Bacevich. He's a political scientist at BU. He served in Vietnam himself. His son was killed in Iraq, and he knows as well as anybody, really, Andrea, what this is all about. And he makes this case that Americans aren't really focused, as we said before, on the impact of military action. We just sort of talk about war in a very abstract way.
Yeah, it's interesting. He makes a parallel to the 99%, 1% cries of the Occupy movement. He says, you know, in this case, 99% of Americans relax and think about war and military intervention as a purely theoretical, you know, thing, while the 1% actually feel all the risk and sacrifice from those decisions. And so, you know, Andrew Bacevich would say to the president, though he is by no means a dove, he's a hawk himself, he would say, don't do this, don't go in. We need to stand back and look at our entire policy across the Middle East, and in fact, in some cases, the world, and our quickness, our speed with which we tend to run towards military solutions for almost any problem.
Now, I wonder if I could, just to bring Scott in for a second, is that okay?
Absolutely, Colin. Yeah, please do.
Scott, if we're now thinking about inspection in an unbelievably abstract way, you know, it just sounds like such a great idea, inspection and monitoring. And you kind of alluded to this a few seconds ago. You said, well, there will be inevitably be casualties. I wonder if you could expand on that. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, once we start this process, it's a matter of time before there's a standoff somewhere where some regional commander says, no, you're not coming in here. You're not going to look at this stuff. Maybe he shoots a couple of inspectors or the troops that are guarding them. I mean, how unravelable is this idea of inspection and monitoring?
Well, that's right. So you only have a few experts in the world that actually can identify and remove these things carefully. So it's a time... Take a lot of time to actually remove the chemical weapons, number one. Number one, first, actually, I should say, you have to secure the environment. That's going to be impossible, I think, without real risk, be on-the-ground risk, not clean risk. You're going to be going to villages. You're going to be rooting around in somebody's backyard. Remember, there might even be some of the, you know, kind of games played by Saddam Hussein, who was moving the weapons ahead of inspectors back in the late 90s. So we would need to have unfettered access. I believe that's language you'll see soon in some resolutions and such. That means thousands of security personnel, hundreds of monitors. Then you've got to destroy this stuff. That actually will take years. Somebody has to pay for it, and it has to be in secure locations. The U.S. has that capability. We've done that. Russia has some of that capability. I still think it's a worthy endeavor. I think it's important to do, but as Andrea was alluding to, it's not without cost. And, you know, make no mistake, these strikes are high-impact explosives, and once they start flying, if we're talking about an actual strike, you're not, as military folks will tell you, the plan changes once the shooting starts. So it's an incredibly kinetic environment. There are dozens of rebel groups, and there are some that are closely affiliated with al-Qaeda and some actual al-Qaeda operating there who will love nothing more than to cause trouble and try to make the whole thing blow up. So that's why I say we would actually need, when I say boots on the ground, that's heavily armed boots on the ground, real personnel, not Fijian lightly armed troops, but we will need highly trained military with command and control capability, trained in human rights, by the way. You can imagine if we have bad reactions to civilians in Syria. So, you know, it's a real military operation to remove those weapons.
If you have thoughts on Syria, we'll take some of your calls in a moment at 860-275-7266 about American involvement, about the proposed Russian deal with Syria and the U.S. Again, 860-275-7266. We want to hear a bit from a Yale panel discussion yesterday on Syria. Mohammed El-Fayoumi is an Egyptian diplomat who's worked in Damascus. He joined us on Where We Live last week. Here he is talking about this issue of American credibility in the region.
Everybody who is following this file will know that the U.S. diplomacy and U.S. political tools have not been used to stop the killing. The objective here, at least from my point of view and from Syrian point of view and Egyptian and the Arab and Muslim point of view and humanitarian point of view, will be to stop the killing, not to restore American leadership, not to regain credibility. The objective must be stop the bloodshed, stop the killing, which is only achievable through a controlled transition. It's not achievable through toppling, just toppling military operation, toppling asset. And it's not achievable through just leaving the war continue.
Akshan, I'm wondering if you could respond to that. This idea of the mixed messages that the United States is sending about why we would need to intervene, about getting chemical weapons out of Assad's hands, about regime change, and about just making sure that the U.S. indeed has credibility in the region. We hear Mohammed El-Fayoumi saying that it's not about American credibility. That ship has sailed. It's really about trying to make sure that the killing stops. Give me your reaction.
I mean, I find it really interesting that in this whole sort of diplomatic maneuvering that goes on between the U.S. and Russia, we really lose sight of what's at stake here and the people who are victims of Assad's crimes. And we talk about U.S. credibility. We talk about, you know, Russia trying to be in the center of the world stage. It becomes more about these two powers and not about the, you know,
and about politics
and
as
about
opposed
politics
to people.
As opposed to people. And I think, I mean, we saw this in the Iraq intervention as well. This sort of list of reasons, justifications to go to war. And I don't want to necessarily draw a lot of similarities between the two, but we seem to, you know, and this is generally what the Russian public is skeptical of, this sort of this constant justification to sort of change the regimes in place. They don't see this, I think, as a limited strike, as much as, you know, Obama is trying to make it that way. They think that it will create so much instability that there will have to be perhaps even troops on the ground. So I think the Russian people, I shouldn't just talk about just the Russians themselves. I think there is war fatigue all over the world. I mean, look at our allies, right? The British public has no stomach for this. To me, the Turkish case is really also interesting. The Turkish government is supporting intervention, and the prime minister put a lot of stake in it. But the public is very much adamantly against it.
And right now we have millions of people going across the borders of Syria to Turkey, to
Absolutely.
Jordan, to Lebanon,
yep.
even into Iraq to try to escape this. I mean, that really has to be a part of this discussion. 100,000 people plus killed, but 2 million people displaced.
Refugees, yeah. And this is a big problem for Turkey economically, security. There are big security concerns in that part of Turkish territory. So, in many ways, what Putin is proposing may not be well thought of, perhaps. We'll see. But it really saves face for a lot of people. And it's a win-win situation for everyone. It's a great opportunity. I don't know if it'll be realistic. I think there's some genius there that...
if you listen to John Kerry, it'll never happen. Well, right. let's go to the phones quickly. Stephen in Bridgeport. Hi, Stephen. Go ahead.
Hello, my name is Stephen from Bridgeport, and I'd like to present maybe another light on this awful tragedy in this situation here. And I'd like to say not only this tragedy here, but as we know, there's people dying and starving all over the world and young children who just want some food. If this was his true intention, I believe there's financial issues here with Halliburton and some other pressure being put on the president here. If he truly cared about people and how they're passing or being killed or just dying from lack of food here in our own country, then I think he'd be pushing, we'd be going in another direction here. There's other things going on, once again, financially in the background, because there's money to be had here in all wars.
Well,
so let's all think about that. I'll just leave that thought with the, there's always money to be had.
Well, Stephen, thank you for that very much. Andrew Seabrook, the calls for war once again in the United States, or the calls against war, we were talking about this earlier in the program before you joined us about whether or not America has a stomach for this at all. You made the case already on our program today that in many ways this has been a more thoughtful Congress than perhaps it has been in the past. Do you really see that moving forward, that maybe a Congress learned some sort of a lesson around Iraq and Afghanistan and won't be too quick to put American boots on the ground in a place like Syria or any place else unless we absolutely have to?
Well, I think it's a little strong to say they learned a lesson. I think probably the members of Congress had years and years of hangover from both the votes to authorize military force in Afghanistan and Iraq. And so in political terms, they learned their lesson. I think the president, though he is making a very strong case, has actually tried to explain that he is reticent to go to any military action. I can't imagine that the man who would like his legacy to be, I ended these, you know, seemingly endless wars, to then want to go into a country and have to deal with this kind of thing. And I think that's why he's constantly talking about how surgical and how clean the strikes would be, whether that's controllable or not. But I think there is strength in allowing himself to look weak by allowing the Congress to go ahead and talk. I think there is an awful lot of chatter right now about, us not acting in the window that we could have, or now looking weak because, you know, the Congress may not back up the president. I think whenever we have rational people taking such a serious thing, in fact, seriously, then we only strengthen ourselves.
Andrea Seabrook is host of the podcast Decode DC. Her most recent podcast is all about Syria, presenting some new ideas on this. She joined us today from the studios of WYPR in Baltimore. Always good to talk to you, Andrea. Thank you very much for joining us.
So glad to be here. Thanks.
I want to thank Scott Bates, who's the president of the Center for National Policy. He joined us by phone today from Washington. Thank you, as always, Scott.
Thank you, John.
Thanks to Akshan Bayulgan, who is an associate professor in UConn's Department of Political Science. Very good to have you here today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And thanks to Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show. Thanks, Colin.
Thanks, John.
Where We Live is produced by Tucker Ives with Betsy Kaplan and Heather Brandon. The senior producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankowski. This is Where We Live.